My name is Dr. Lindsay Weisner. I'm a psychologist, author, a mom, and still an occasional shit show. You're listening to the Neurotic Nourishment Podcast. This is a place for smart, sweary women to talk about stuff that matters, stuff that can make us uncomfortable, but stuff that helps us to learn and grow and be okay with living in that discomfort of not knowing the right thing to say or do all the time. Thanks for listening. You can also find me on Instagram at PsychShrinkMom or at Neurotic Nourishment. In today's episode of Neurotic Nourishment, I get to reconnect with Ryan Campbell, also known as R.R. Campbell. I can honestly say that this was one of my favorite conversations I have ever had while podcasting, and Ryan may very well be quickly becoming one of my favorite human beings. To be clear, when I say this was one of my favorite conversations, that does not mean it was an easy one to have. Our conversation starts with the power of words and what we should and shouldn't say when discussing suicide and mental health. The truth is, I'm not a fan of tiptoeing around word choice and diction because I believe intentions matter more. But intentions are all about perspective. Ryan and I discuss what happens in the aftermath of a parent's suicide attempt, the power of humor to get us through tough situations, and how to move forward after someone you love takes their own life. Spoiler alert, throwing yourself into your work, no matter how passionately you feel about your work, is just another form of escapism and possibly addiction. Ryan is an International Book Awards finalist, the Kraft Developmental Chair for the Wisconsin Writers Association, and the founder of the WriteCast Network, a podcast collective that's been helping creatives worldwide become more confident in themselves and in their craft since 2016. Ryan's newest book, And Ampersand, Short Stories on Endings and Beginnings of a Sort, is currently available for pre-order at www.books2read.com/and-ampersand. Again, that's books2read.com/and-ampersand. You can find out more about Ryan at ryancampbell.com, on Twitter at @IamRRCampbell, on Instagram at @IamRRCampbell, and on Facebook at, you guessed it, @IamRRCampbell. I'm not issuing a trigger alert because the title of this episode makes it pretty clear that we're talking about suicide. But if this episode does become too difficult or too personal for you to listen to, I apologize, turn it off, and go do something fun. If you can learn from this, fantastic. Either way, this conversation meant a lot to me. And I hope it means a lot to you. Thanks for listening. Start.
Cool.
Ryan, thank you so much for being here to talk about this. Suicide is one of the, I'm gonna say my favorite things to talk about, even though that sounds weird, but it's to, you know, try to destigmatize and to make it more, make people less afraid of it and more aware of it, if that makes sense.
It does. And it's a tricky thing to like strike that balance with, you know. I can already tell that just, you know, in the way that you choose your words there, it's like, it's such a, the line is so fine between like, how can we raise awareness about a thing without, you know, there's that idea of like newspapers not writing stories about people or, you know, who do commit suicide because they don't want to encourage other people. And it's just what's the right choice? We don't know, but we got to have a discussion about it if we're going to actually see what we want to do. So.
Exactly. And then I think we spoke about this previously when I was on, you know, your now defunct. I feel like I should do like a sign of the cross thing, but I'm a Jew. I do it wrong. So, although I know it's like testicles, spectacles, whatever. My first book was released in March, as you know, and it's, humorously it's sitting in front of me along with like 150 other copies in the other room, still waiting for that release party that, you know, never came to be.
Eventually, you know.
I know. But like, I really tried to turn it into a, and the stigma of, you know, suicide awareness because of, you know, several things that had happened around the same time. And I was contacted by someone, well, a few things online. Some people reached out to me. There was a mom and her son had committed suicide, and the word committed suicide is now up for, you know,
right.
Topic of discussion. And so I understood it from her point of view, but I also felt like, if we have to watch our words, we're missing the point. But then again, it's not my child, you know, so it's
right. Yeah. Well, it's fraught. It's fraught because like everyone's going to have a, when it affects you personally, you feel like you have additional, you know, skin in the game. Right. Yeah. And it's not just about like how you want to navigate. It's not like you're navigating it that way by choice. It's like you are suddenly finding yourself confronting these very serious, you know, emotions, and they're very strong, and they're the kind of thing that, you know, you don't want anyone else to have to confront, but you do find yourself getting very particular about the language sometimes, which, you know, for me, the idea of, I guess, like committing suicide, I understand why someone wouldn't want to, you know, use that terminology, but that one doesn't bother me as much as I see, an interesting one is you see a lot of these like suicide survivor support groups. And when I hear that term,
oh, that bothers me.
Yeah, I really don't like that term. Because, you know, whatever, if that's what you want to use, great. But like for me, that doesn't sound like
ownership.
You know, I wouldn't say that I'm a suicide survivor because I lost my father to suicide. I would say someone who attempted suicide and survived would be a suicide survivor. Like it just semantically.
Oh, wait,
to me,
I actually thought that it was.
Right. And it's not right. And that's why it's even more challenging because the semantics of it are just completely, to me, backward. I mean, it communicates a very different thing than I would have expected. So I know we're in the semantic space, but, you know, it's all part of that conversation. So.
But words are important to both of us. And, right. You know, and that's why it's not, it's coincidental and yet not coincidence, obviously, that it's the words that we start with. You know, I also was contacted by the Long Island suicide prevention woman, something. And she informed me that they actually don't want to use the word stigma because even just the stigma conjures up a stigma. And it was like, we in the mental health field. And so I Googled her. She's not in the mental health field, but whatever. It's good. She's, you know, dedicating her time to something wonderful, but like, fuck off. Like, I'm not, you know, like, I'm not traumatizing my, you know, like.
It's turtles all the way down eventually, right? You know, it's just kind of, it's what do we want to make of it and how do we want to have our conversation? And it's like, again, I'm going to respect someone's space and their choice and how they want to handle it, so long as it doesn't become, I think, prescriptive. And I think that sort of like prescriptivist standpoint, I think in many things in life, is really where you start to run into this whole like, well, hey, why do you get to decide how I, someone who's personally affected by this, am going to respond, how I'm going to speak about it? And I think that it's fine to have your thoughts and feelings, but we don't need to like force them on other people, I guess, which it cuts both ways.
Apparently we do. Apparently we all think we do.
Right. And that's the interesting thing is like me saying that makes me realize it cuts both ways because here they are saying, you know, a word like stigma comes with this baggage to them. And therefore I ask that you don't do it. So it's kind of like there's no way to win with it, which again only furthers the this sort of like positive feedback loop of how can we even start to set up a frame of reference in which the conversation can be had. So,
right, I agree. So, tell me about your dad.
Yeah. So my dad. You know, to just put the explicit statement of it out there, you know, he took his own life in March of 2016. I hate to start with that because, you know, that's not the single event that of course defines him. And I know that's not what your question was meant to get at.
It's a single event that defines, you know, this moment, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And that's why I wanted to make sure that that was, you know, clear for folks who are tuning into the conversation. But I mean, my dad as a person was, you know, he was someone who cared deeply, I think, about his family and his children, and the business that he ran with his business partner that, you know, he had, it was a real, it's really interesting. I joked with one of my uncles, one of the ways that I cope with, you know, my dad's loss was some pretty dark humor. And one of the things that I, that I joked with one of my uncles about, after, you know, my dad died was that, you know, my dad didn't kill himself. The American dream killed him.
Gotcha.
And I talked about it in the context of like, here is a man who did not have a college degree. He got out of high school and eventually found his way into woodwork. And he just started on the floor. He didn't have a background in carpentry or anything like that, but he just, you know, took to it in the shop that he worked. And over the course of a handful of years, became proficient enough at it, showed a knack for salesmanship, became, you know, the head salesman at that company. Actually, it was a smaller outfit, and then went from being in that position of sales to eventually, when the owner was looking to retire, he got together with someone who had been a customer of, you know, the place that he was working, and they bought it out. And so it was this real, it just showed a lot of dedication, I think, on his part, not only to what was important to him, you know, was having ownership of that. He was someone who really, you know, when you can hold something like that in your hands and make it what you want to make it, he wasn't doing that just for himself though either. You know, it was part of him wanting to create more opportunities for me and for my sisters and for my mom. So, you know, that was a big driving force in, I think, who he was as a person. He let that define himself to such an extent that I think when things didn't go quite as well as he would have liked, you saw him confronting things that he hadn't had to confront previously. And that was part of a long road to where he ultimately ended up, I guess.
So what do we, now I'm curious about the woodwork aspect of it. What, like crafting things?
Yeah, it was all handmade stuff. So what they did is they actually worked in the commercial environment. So they would work particularly with a couple of different marketing companies who would take bids from companies like Microsoft, Best Buy, Toyota dealerships, things of that nature. And they'd get these really big contracts. And then they would have to, as part of executing those marketing campaigns, turn to different suppliers. And so you'd have maybe at a Toyota dealership, I know one of the things that they made nationwide at one point was the like coffee stands. So when you went in to buy a car at a Toyota dealership, you know, your display where the coffee's laid out with the carafe and all that jazz, it sat on something, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was stuff that was made by my dad's company, by people who, you know, had decades of experience doing this stuff by hand. And they, it was kind of like an assembly line process, but it was, everyone kind of had ownership of, you know, one part of that. And then they would ship it out over the course of time. And you found the stuff in, like I say, it was Best Buy, Toyota. They did some stuff for Microsoft for Xbox at one point. So they were doing pretty well for themselves.
But it also sounds like there's something that got lost along the way about the love for the work and maybe like the bigger picture.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true because he was, of course, you know, in the shop at one point and he was learning the ins and outs of it. And he had that, you know, what success was, I think, to him changed over time, because I have to imagine, you know, because I worked in that shop.
Okay.
Summers and winters growing up as a teenager and then early in college, and I'd come home on breaks just to help out. And there is something to be said for the experience of making something with your hands and then setting it aside, giving it to the next person in the process and watching them maybe like stain it or finish it. And then it gets on a truck and you go, cool, I did my part.
Right.
And then you're just kind of waiting for the next project to come through. And then you tackle that as it rolls your way. But when you're in a position of management and you get away from, you know, your work table and you find yourself suddenly managing not just what's going on in the shop for purposes of quality control, but also actively drumming up those new leads, looking for those new sales, seeing what's down the pipeline. It's stuff that I think you, as someone who is, you know, in a business environment, you know, with the clients that you have to have different hats that you wear. I have to do the same thing as an author. And so where does the joy come in? For me, it's, well, when I can sit down in the morning with my coffee and write. It's not necessarily all of the business side of it, but you have to do it. And I think my dad got too far from maybe the more immediate business that was within his truly within his hands, and got so caught up in the, how do we look down the pipeline? How do we stay profitable? It's just that chase, and burnout happens, and then, you know, calamity ensues and some bad luck along the way. And there you are.
So how did, so So your dad, we had mentioned that before I hit record that this was like the 5-year anniversary of the first time, right?
Yeah, it is. The first time my dad tried to take his life was very late 2015. It was in the final week of the year. I remember my now wife, at the time we were just dating, but we had gone to a Packer game at Lambeau Field the night before, and the Packers were playing the Vikings. The Packers lost. It was a big, you know, they lost.
By the way, you just have like every like Wisconsin stereotype.
I know.
Like that is literally all I know about Wisconsin. You just put together, like, tell me you were eating cheese and that's it.
Oh yeah. I mean, I remember there were definitely some cheese curds to be had at the stadium. Right. You know, everything's great. And I had a really strong connection to the Wisconsin-ness of it here with my dad and the Packers. Right. Tickets to Lambeau to go watch the Packers play are extremely hard to come by. And I didn't get a chance to go to a game until, God, my early 20s, probably. And every time I went, it was with my dad. You know, we had one other excursion with the whole family, but we would go, we would always have a great time. We'd get, you know, decent seats, whatever we could scrounge up. And, but I would go to this game with my wife, and Packers lose. Next day, I wake up to a phone call from one of my sisters, and it's rare for my sisters and I to talk on the phone. It's become increasingly more, you know, normal in the last couple of years. So when I saw that she called, I was like, well, okay, someone's dead. Yeah. You know, there's just that moment of dread where, you know, right away that something is not correct here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I answered, and she told me that my dad had tried to kill himself. And the pause, you know, like when you use a word like gravity and you say the gravity of a moment like that, most of the time when you say something like that, it's kind of a phrase that you throw out of hand. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, you know, the gravity of the situation, whatever. But to the definition of the word gravity, like the concept of this sort of like mass pulling in everything and weighing everything down, just like you don't forget that kind of thing.
No.
And so it became a dash. You know, I live in the Madison area. My family's from the Milwaukee area. So it wasn't like I had to go cross country, but it was an hour and a half drive or so. My girlfriend at the time, now wife, she drove me, and I got there, and we couldn't see my dad. He was at the hospital at that point, you know, in a room recovering. And just the waiting's the worst, you know, because you don't know, and you have so many questions. You want to ask someone like, well, what's going on, man? Like, what can we do to help? How, like, you're waiting for doctors to tell you whether your dad's even going to be okay, you know, after what's just happened.
Can I ask how he tried?
So the first time that he tried, he had taken, I believe it was some of my mom's sleeping pills. And then he also, much to the doctor's surprise, went into the garage and drank gasoline. Before laying down on the couch and just kind of like waiting, I guess. It was my youngest sister who found him, actually, because she had come downstairs hoping that my dad could like move his truck to, you know, so she could get her car out and go to school.
Right.
And that was, you know, who knows, had she not come down at the right time or whatever the case is. But
I'm also surprised by the gasoline.
Yes, I know. Very strange. And they didn't even know that until we had the opportunity to see him. You know, we walked into the room when we could finally see my dad. There's two parts of this. One's going to tie back into the Wisconsin-ness, and the other will tie into the gasoline. You know, I walked in, and my dad, you know, his eyes were like half open. You see him, he's hooked up to all the machines. And the first thing he said was, "Ryan's here." That was quick.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, so we're lucid. You know what's going on. And my immediate response to him was, I know the Packers lost, but it's not that bad. And he kind of got this, you know, very doped up smirk on his face. And I was like, you're still here, you know, and just the terrible, it was like this sort of like terrible relief where you're like, oh, thank God. But you're also realizing like, oh, this is so real. Now.
Right. You know, people are going to hate the fact that I just laughed at that. And people are going to hate the fact that that was your response. But I understand, because like, I come from that same dark place of like, a phone call could mean anything, you know? And
right.
So, especially after the first time, and never mind
a second, I don't know how many that, you know, but like you have to find humor in the horror. And my people are the people who will laugh with me and understand that I'm not, well, I am an asshole, but differently, but like, I'm not being an asshole at the time. I'm just like, this is how I have to use, this is how I have to pivot my world to get through.
Right. And I think that, you know, this is another one of those situations where it's like, look, if you want to be mad at me for that being my response, like nothing in my power is going to stop anyone from being that way. But I think the context in which that exists is one where we're talking about something that my dad and I would be able to recognize each other on right away. We'd be able to see each other and understand. And that was just kind of how our relationship was. So it was to me, the sort of like, it was the only thing to say. Because what do you say to someone in that position? You have to, there is that, it's the idea of that, it's the breaking of the ice. It's like you're meeting again them again for the first time. Yeah. And they're a completely new person, and so are you. And so what happens here? And that's actually, you know, the second part of that, of course, was related to the gasoline, because we walked into that room and, you know, hospitals have a smell. There's that hospital smell. It's just, that's how they clean them, whatever. We're in that room and I was just like, man, it smells weird in here. It smelled like someone was running a generator or something like that, like a gas powered generator. And there was a little bit of a kerfuffle after I, you know, made my statement. Some maybe Ryan gasps from like my mom or my sister or whatever. But there was then this sort of debate of like, well, what's going on? You know, why does it smell in here? Can we move him to another room? And then my dad kind of like lost some of his lucidity a little bit. And my mom just had this intuition about like, she looks at my dad and goes, Rob, did you drink gasoline?
Weird.
He didn't want to answer that question. And so the doctor who was still there kind of looked at him and then looked at us and went, okay, we didn't know he did that. Like we knew that he had at that point. And so that was another, we had to leave the room immediately because they were not prepared for that particular twist or turn. He had to be taken elsewhere for x-rays because, you know, if you drink gasoline, you know, it goes in your stomach, but the vapors can get up into your lungs. And if it gets into your lungs and condenses or something like that, that's like it, you know, like then that's it. So we went from the situation of just like, okay, he's here and he can be fine and he's going to recover to suddenly being ushered out of the room and put back in waiting. Cause like we have a highly flammable man who might drown in his own lungs.
Right. Right. Yeah. My mom wouldn't drink gasoline unless there was like, unless it has an alcohol content, actually.
Right. Yeah. It's just, you know, ethanol. Does that count? I don't know, but
I don't know, but I also don't know how it would occur to someone to do that.
I think, I have to imagine it was like for him, a hedging of bets, you know, he probably took that medication and just went like, what can I do to really see this through? You know, cause clearly he was a man on a mission that morning and, it's just trying to get yourself in that headspace entirely is of course like horrible to do, but it's also just, if you were to try to do it, like that's the only rationale you can think of for someone whose brain is not in a wholly rational spot, I guess.
Right. And then he recovered. Okay.
Yeah, he actually recovered. He was on his way to, you know, as full of a recovery as one can have. I forget how many days he spent in, you know, the hospital plus then being an inpatient on the unit there and having like the mandated therapy. And then you got like your mandated court appearance because, you know, the criminalization of the whole thing and what kind of program is he going to be like?
We don't have that in Florida.
You don't. Okay. So see, that's the other interesting thing too, is me looking at this and this kind of ties into the idea of like committing suicide. Like,
I agree, but at least there's some follow-up there.
Right. There is. And that was, you know, I think it was good to the extent that it made it harder for him to have a moment of desperation in the immediate aftermath and try to follow through again. But I do know that someone, you know, one of the traits that my dad and I share is that being in that environment and not having control over where one goes, not having control over like the ability to see one's like partner or family or like tend to matters, like these were only actually exacerbating what was driving his anxiety and his depression. And so there became a point where, you know, he got out because the court only said he had to do it for so long. It was maybe a week or something like that. And then he's out. And then it's like, okay, well, now what? Like, you're not just magically better. Like, you have some medication that you're on, and there was a plan put in place to ensure that he wasn't like just rushing back to work, which of course he cared about and was important to him. And as one of the two people running the place, like, you lose your Rob, you lose a big chunk of that operation. So he did his best to stay away from it as long as he could. And a couple months pass and he was slowly phasing back into work. It seemed like he was doing well. He had his birthday in February of that year, came home, saw him. He was, again, still very anxious, not quite the same, you know, that you'd be used to interacting with him, not quite the same person you'd be used to. And then I just remember on his birthday, you know, and I'm heading back to Madison, and he gave me like the world's longest, hardest hug, which is never, not a big thing for my dad. Yeah. You know, like, we hugged, we did, of course we did. But there was just like, he was really hanging on to that. And I, you know, at the time I was like, good, he's here. Like, he's feeling this and we need that. We need family. And like, I'm going to do everything I can to help you out here. But I think part of him knew in that moment that that was going to be the last one, because it was a couple of weeks later that he did actually succeed. Yeah, there was a second attempt and he succeeded. So,
quickly.
Yeah, it was a matter of, you know, end of December to first week of March. I think it was March 2nd was the date that he finally, for lack of a better adverb, because if we need one at all, that he did end up succeeding. So, period of 3 months that really changes everything.
Yeah.
Not to overstate it, but there's no other way to put it.
No, and it's also such a small amount of time. I mean, I was 17 when I found out about my mother's first attempt, and then because she told me, and told me it was my fault, because, you know.
Cool. Hashtag parenting.
Yeah, parenting goals. You know, I'm 43 now, and so it's, I don't math well at all. I can spell, like, I can spell the shit out of things, but I can't math. So, you know, like, there's been so many years and attempts and adjustments, but like, you had 3 months to wrap your brain around this possibility.
Right. And it was, you know, in the interim, I naturally sought out the help of a therapist, you know, which was not new to me. I had seen one, you know, I think at some point in my teens. And then there's a break in there, and then again a little bit later. So sure. It wasn't a new thing, but having to go through that in this capacity, you know, you do get out all those emotions, and you try to process as much of it as you can. But there was always kind of like, I don't know if it's like things that I should know as an author, right? But I don't know if it's like an Edgar Allan Poe story where, you know, you see it in old classic cartoons. It's like the blade that's hanging over you that's slowly getting closer. It was like, part of me always felt like that was still there. And it was hard to tell sometimes if it was actually getting closer or if it was just always going to be there at the same distance. And you just never knew, you know, would the ceiling eventually give out, or like, would it just in one fell swoop come and grab you? But I think in retrospect, you know, you look at that and you go, part of me knew.
Yeah.
You know, I remember telling my therapist, like, just like, I don't think, I so desperately wanted he was so close to being able to retire, you know, and then he'd be free of like the biggest stressors here and he would have more options available to him. I just remember telling my therapist, I was like, I don't know if like he can even think that far out right now. And when you can't, then where are you? You're right back where you were, you know, those 3 months ago, and then that's it.
So. Right. And how did you find out about his death?
I was working my day job out in kind of west side of Madison and just at my desk. And I got a call from, you know, my girlfriend. I think we were just dating at the time still. And she,
I'm going to invent a name for your wife at some point.
Yeah, I know. Lacey is my wife's name. So we'll just use that name going forward here. But I get a call from her, and a little unusual. Normally we would text during the day, but I'm like, oh, whatever. It's probably just like, hey, I didn't know if you saw my text thing. But I answer and she goes, hey, I'm going to come pick you up at work. And I was like, oh, are we like getting lunch? Like, what's the occasion? And she was like, well, your sister texted me and just asked me to pick you up from work. And I was like, okay. I don't want you to have to be involved in this any more than you need to be kind of thing. I just said, you know, I'm kind of like, I'm having that panicky moment because it's like, information's being kept from me. I don't like this. This isn't like last time when someone just came out and told me what happened. I need answers. I'm like my ass if I'm getting in a car and telling my boss, like, what am I going to tell my supervisor? Oh, hey, sorry, my wife's picking me up. I may or may not be back for an indefinite period of time. Like,
yeah.
So I call my sister and she didn't answer, which fine, I understand. Then I called my mom and I just said, hey, you know, like what's going on? And she just tried to say like, you know, Lacey's going to come pick you up at work and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, you have to tell me what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
Like what the fuck is happening here? I'm an adult man. Like this is not, I'm not going to be like kidnapped. The only person I trust in this situation right now is Lacey.
Right.
And my mom just said, your dad's dead, Ryan, he's gone.
Wow.
And you know, I'm standing in the row of cubes where I work and just like, it's just so tropey and so dramatic to think, but like my knees did buckle and I sat right in the middle of the damn floor. Cause then you're like, well, here we are.
Right.
This is what I thought and it happened. And there's not even like a, you know, my immediate thought was, well, I have to call my dad and see if this is true.
Right.
Which I didn't do because like who would make that shit up, you know? And like, of course they didn't, but like you immediately jump into that denial stage of like, well, if I call my dad and he tells me it's true, then I know it's true. And it's like, that doesn't even make any fucking sense, but of course it doesn't.
Yeah.
Like your brain is just grasping at straws to
get out of this, to like,
right, it is. It's that like, hey, can we go ahead and play the tape back? And like, I won't answer the phone call a minute ago and then it won't have happened.
Right.
And it's like, well, that's not how any of that works, but there you are. So it's just, and then it's, you know, you're going through the motions. You have a week, 2 weeks, months of your life where it's just like, all right, what's the thing that we have to do to just like bury him? Cause then you hope that like once that the person's buried, that it's like, okay, now we can grieve. But like, what's grief going to look like? You have no idea and you have no idea how it's going to affect you. So, it was it had been like a terrible, miserable, late Wisconsin, you know, winter into spring there. And, but then of course, like my dad dies and the next day it was like a beautiful goddamn day. We had like a 60 some degree day. And I was like, fuck, maybe if he could have hung on through like the gray, like maybe he would have had a day. And it's like you start doing all these justifications, that's the bargaining thing. And I don't need to walk you or your listeners through this, you guys know all that stuff, but it's just like watching yourself go through it in real time is like a trip,
right?
And then trying to decide what it's going to mean for you long term is like that's the next stage, you know, that's what you start trying to figure out next. And
did you have these like moments of like wanting to pick up the phone and call him when like,
And not even in the context of just like, oh, I wish my dad would answer because I know he's dead. Like I'd be driving home from work and that was when I would call my dad most of the time. Like maybe once or twice a month, like call my dad, just like, what are we going to talk about? Well, we're going to talk about the Packers for a minute. We're going to talk about random sports shit. And then we'll talk about family and that'll be that. It'll be a 15 minute call. Cool. Nice talking to you. But you'd find yourself, you know, driving home and I reach for my little like Bluetooth things. I want to say like, hey, call dad, and you just stop.
And you forget. Yeah.
You forget. Your brain's searching for it. Your brain knows what it wants to do. Your brain's looking for that routine. And then like the absence of that is just like, those moments are in many ways, like they are the smaller, but equally meaningful devastations of
life. Oh yes.
You know, it's the same as that moment of hearing like he's gone. It's just like, oh, I guess I'm going to be slapped in the face today again by this, just because that's how it's going to have to be for a while.
It's like the negative space that remains.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really what it is. Yeah.
See, I found a pretty way to say it.
There it is.
But yeah, it's, you know, I mean, and then also, yes, the stages of grieving and then, I don't know. Were you angry? Are you angry?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I was mad as hell. But it wasn't directed at my dad. Interestingly, it was directed at other people in my family because just, I know the relationship that my dad and I had was, I think, a little different than the relationship he might've had with others in my family. And just, I started doing like the look backs to like things that my dad might've said and like frustrations he was having with like family. And like another person I was very angry at was his business partner. Because I would just be like, yeah, God damn it. Why didn't everyone lay off? Yeah. Like, why couldn't the world have laid off him for like a goddamn second? Like, I kind of had this thought in my mind that, like, you know, my dad wasn't to blame for this. It was a hashtag society, man. You know, like, why the fuck could everyone just lower their expectations for a second and let him breathe? So yeah, anger was a really big part of it for a while, on and off. And it probably is, in some ways, like to this day, the one that comes in flashes now and then, even 5 years later. Yeah.
At other people still.
What was that?
At other people, though, not
at other people still. Yeah. You know, like maybe once or twice in there ever was I just like, God damn it, Dad, what the fuck's the matter with you? But it's like, it's so hard to, I always found it so hard to blame him, because it was like, I know what creates that, because like I see the traits in him that led him down that road to ruin. Like, I have many of them.
Sure.
And I know, and it's taken a lot of therapy and a lot of like self-reflection to go like, well, how can I use those traits only to my advantage and not let it become this sort of like Atlas holding the world up situation where you no longer have the coping mechanisms available to like set the world down once in a while. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's kind of how I was able to, at least, you know, thus far in my life, like make those paths diverge while like honoring that can still be a thing that you can do once in a while, I guess.
Well, I think that's that where the creativity comes in, where that like that well of pain is also a source of, I was going to say pleasure, which sort of fits in with your podcast and that whole transition, but it's not the right word and sounds much worse than I intended it. So how did you end up with books?
Yeah, that's
because I don't know what your day job was, although it involved cubicles, so all I can think is office space and boring.
Yeah, it was much of what I did after college was, up until about that time, it was a lot of like office work. You know, I worked in an agriculture firm for a while, handling their accounts in Latin America, because I speak Spanish and Portuguese, and that was a little more outside of town than I wanted. So I ended up transitioning to a job in the Madison area that was medical devices, but doing the same thing, you know, Latin American account work. And I guess what led me to books was, I had for many years prior to anything happening with my dad, wanted to write a novel. And I had written some. Starting in like 2012 was when I started taking it more seriously. But then for a while, when I wasn't working office jobs and I was delivering pizza late night in a college town. And then I was like managing that. I was an assistant manager at that restaurant for a while. And I was still doing late nights, but you got to be up early in the morning for the meetings. And just like, what does your schedule become? How do you find time to write? And everything happens in the margins.
Yeah.
And then once I started working in an office environment, it was like, okay, well, I do have some structure that I can work with here. And like, I'm going to write, you know, on my lunches, and maybe once in a while, like when I come home from work, I'll find time to write and we'll get it done eventually. But after my dad died, it was just like this sort of like, what the fuck am I doing? You know, you suddenly go, I've always had, you know, this existential like angst of like, how will I transcend my time? I think everyone confronts that at some point in their life. But like, for me, I've never been someone who's like, I've never considered myself someone who would have kids one day. You know, that's not something my wife and I intend to do. So it's kind of like, well, what am I going to do? I need to become bigger than who I am. And so after my dad died, I was like, well, shit, I need to, one, distract myself, and two, like, it's time to become serious about this. And so after he died, I started writing every day. I wrote by getting up an hour early in the morning, you know, earlier than I normally would for work. And I'd sit down with my coffee and I would write. And then it was every day at my lunch, no excuses, middle fingers to the world. I don't care if you see me in the break room and you have a quick thought. I don't care if you want to like get a meeting or you want to discuss an email. My headphones are on and you can fuck off into the darkness. Like, I'm writing right now. And that was, you know, it was a bit of a renaissance artistically and creatively, because I had control over something. And that was part of the grieving process, I'm sure, too. And it was okay, I have this, I'm writing a book, I've got another book, I'm trying to shop them around, I'm trying to find an agent, like, you know, this game.
And yes, I hate this game, but that's the same way I wrote my first book that got me an agent and won me the contest, because I got up at 5 a.m., you know, I had lost my mother-in-law, I had like 8 major losses at once, and like, I know that early rising is a symptom of depression, but at the time I didn't make the connection, you know?
Well, I didn't even realize that. That's something I never knew was a,
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, obviously not everyone has everything, but I'm not really a morning person. And yet I do realize that, like, during the pandemic, I'm up at 5 a.m. every day, you know?
Yeah.
So, I did the same thing, and it was the writing in the morning. You know, I had 2 young kids, and that was the only time I had to myself, and it was writing away the grief and somehow telling a story of loss that wasn't the fictionalized, you know, version of what I had lost. So
right, and that was kind of once I got to the stage of like, okay, now I'm playing the agent game, and I've got like this techno thriller that in many ways also was about loss. I don't think it's the strongest theme in the book, but you have characters who are tussling with separation from their partner for a prolonged period of time. You do, in fact, and this was written into the book as I envisioned it long before anything happened with my dad. You know, you have a character in that book, a father figure who does commit suicide. And I was very nervous about rewriting that scene, about revisiting that scene, wondering whether I should write it out, because I'm like, well, if this does get published someday, I don't want someone to be like, oh, that, you know, that poor man, he just can't, you know, like, look at him just writing this stuff. It's just, I got in my own head about it, kind of thing. And eventually I just had to set that project aside and focus on a novel that was meant to be kind of just for fun and for me. And it was about an adult film star turned accountant who gets stuck in an IRS audit of a money laundering scheme she had no idea she was part of. So like, very different, very not me, very out of my wheelhouse. But it's a thing in my control. I could dedicate myself to doing a bunch of like research on what it's like to work in that industry and what kind of person would do this. And you write that book and then you're like, okay, well, again, how is any of this getting me closer to like my goal of like publication and like transcendence, and how am I going to do this? So it was just I just started throwing the book about the porn star out into the universe. I was like, you know what, whatever, if this one gets me something cool.
Exactly. Yeah.
and then it did. Of course it did. You know, like that book that I wrote just as like a one-off, that wasn't my big serious thing. And then that book opened the door for the publication of that sci-fi series I had been working on. And then you suddenly find yourself, and this is where the great irony came in, was I recognized in my dad, you know, these traits that were causing him to take on more and more and more, and to just say like, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. And that was a big factor in like his final months of life turning out the way that they did. But now I was in a position where we're talking a timeline of, this is the year 2018 now. I suddenly had 3 book contracts hanging over me, and I needed to write to deadline, and I needed to be revising one and actively writing another that didn't exist yet. And also I was getting married, and we were going to be moving into a new house, and like all of this happening in a 12-month span. And this is when I was introduced to the term generalized anxiety disorder, right? It became a huge, I was so doggedly in pursuit of that success because I told myself this is what it was all for.
Yeah.
You know, you did this, you earned this, you can make it happen. And it wasn't until it took me years of like sort of a slow burn crash until I think the end of 2019, or maybe even as the pandemic set in, where I was just like, why? You know, like, why do I need to say yes to everything? It's not actually helping. I'm just falling into the same trap that like ensnared my father. Like, how is it that I can still achieve my goals without this, you know, without having to get refills of my hydroxyzine at the fucking pharmacy, you know, however often I need to do that kind of thing, or like self-medicating or whatever the case needs to be. Cause it's just like,
mine is overachieve and then self-medicate with booze. So
Like, and everyone's got a thing. Like there's always, you know, and I was telling myself, like, I know it doesn't have to be this way, because there was a time when I just wrote and that was enough.
Right.
You know? And so that's why there's been this big transition for me and going from, okay, here I am, I've cultivated this personality, it's R.R. Campbell. And we talked about this in the episode you did over on the Rightscast Network, like, the voice I'm using with you in this conversation is very different than the voice I used on my podcast. Hey there, this is RR. Like, what was that? Come on.
I don't know, but I was thinking about it. And like, first of all, recall that you're talking to someone who decided to do their yoga teacher training during the pandemic. Right. 200 hours. Like, I didn't have enough shit going on, you know?
Yep.
But there was at one point when during the teacher training, this woman was talking about being a brand. Mm-hmm. And all I could think is, oh, no, I know I'm a brand. Like, I've been branding myself for the last, you know, 2-3 years, you know, and it started on a whim. And then there was a book, and then there was this, and then there was just that. And then, like, you know, and we become these images of ourselves that we sell. And, like, you know, it's...
It doesn't feel great when it gets too far from who you are as a person. It's just very like, I recognize that like, that's who I'm going to be to some people. Like, so long as those podcasts are up and available, and that's fine to some extent, that's fine. But what I had to do was like, it was the same stage of grief though in a different lane in like 2016, when it's like, okay, my dad is dead. What the fuck am I going to do? Now it's kind of like, I have created this monster. How the fuck do I like put it to bed? Cause I didn't want to kill the monster, but I did want to find a way to say that it's like, okay to like put on your, you know, stocking cap and your pajamas and lay down for a minute. So it was like, I need to do a soft like restart. And that's where the idea came in of, well, I love podcasting. I love having the chance to have conversations like this or yeah. conversations about writing, whatever, but it has to go away. Cause there's no way for me to healthily do it. And so the Rightscast Network gets faded out and I say, all right, 2021, here's what's happening. I'm going to stop writing, you know, a very genre-y fiction, you know, your sci-fi kind of stuff, because what speaks to me truly in my heart is more of like contemporary stuff with maybe a little bit of a speculative bent, and maybe it's a little more upmarket than what folks are used to, but that's where I thrive. That's not where R.R. Campbell thrives.
Right.
And then knowing that, I had to also say, okay, plant flag and ground. There's going to be this period of time where you're going to know me as R.R. Campbell, but also as Ryan R. Campbell. And they're going to write different things and you're going to have to get used to it, because this is what needs to happen for me to, like, again, take control of my own creative destiny. And also just my destiny as a person.
Yeah.
Because that's, you got to be fulfilled personally before I think you can be, well, maybe this isn't true, but I'm going to say that it is in my case. I need to be fulfilled to some extent personally before I can truly be fulfilled creatively. Like, they have to work in tandem. And if I can't get those two in sync, then what's the point of any of it? And so, right. You know, here we are now recording this late 2020, and I'm looking at 2021, like, all right, for the first time in years, it's like I'm breathing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I mean, but I also think that we're also in a field where it's, I'm putting us in the writing field right now, where it's very difficult to, like, I mean, there's editors, there's agents, there's, you know, like the, my book that I've, you know, I have an agent, but it was the one that was never published. Cause my agent doesn't do nonfiction. She right. does fiction, whatever. The thing for me was when we started talking about changing the name, and like, I was so in love with the title of the book because it meant so much to me. And yes, you know, like, basically by the end of all of the edits, like, what I'm okay with the fact that it didn't get published, because I don't know who the fuck wrote that anyway at the right. end of it, you know?
Yep.
And so it's tough to like stick your foot in the ground and be like, you know, like, we want that publication so badly, but we also want to keep ourselves, and it easily gets lost, you know?
Yeah. And I think that was a big part of what pushed me to sort of really embrace that like identity of myself as R.R. Campbell, is because there were so many other cooks in the kitchen, and you're trying to do the things that like you're quote unquote supposed to do. You're doing all the checklists, you're doing all like the boilerplate stuff, and you've got input from your editor, you've got input from other folks at your publisher. They want this, they want that. And you just kind of, you have to politic it. You know, it's what's the political capital available to me? When do I put my foot down? How hard do I put it down? And like, how does that affect our relationship going forward? And I think that that is all still going to be there. You know, should I find myself in a position to be back in traditional publishing under this new name? But for now, you know, I look at kind of what I've done the last few years, and it's like, well, I haven't had a book out since what, early 2019, I guess, maybe April 2019. And that doesn't mean I haven't been writing. I've written a ton of books since then, but they just sit on a shelf. And so now I'm kind of looking at them going, these are still good books. I know that some of them are maybe not as marketable traditionally published as others, and that's fine. Right. So what do I do? Well, I'm going to take control of the process and do a slow rollout, you know, indie pub of my back catalog. And that's right. Fine.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to have, you know, there'll be input from others in the process along the way, but it's not going to be the same because you have that sort of control. So it's kind of a, that's the space that I'm breathing in while also knowing that I do have manuscripts I'm working on now where I'm like, I'm still going to give them a shot with agents. I'm still going to give them a shot on Query Road. I'm going to take my time with them, not rush them. But just letting yourself kind of exist in the space that doesn't feel like you're doing everything to like please someone else.
Right.
Now it's not about for me writing a book that's going to get an agent's attention. Like I'm aware of the idea of a reader as I write, you know, or at least as I revise, but I'm not sitting there like gaming my book such that it gets the attention of like this mythical creature.
Right.
Just write the book and feel good about it. You can do that. And then if it works out, then it's like Accounting for It All, the book about the porn star.
Yeah.
That book worked out because I wrote with my shoulders down.
Yeah. I miss that. I miss that writing for the love of writing. Like yeah. The writing that I've done has been for Psychology Today, for my blog, for, you know, some freelance stuff, but I have not given myself permission to go into that fiction world during the pandemic. I don't know why, probably for some deep-seated reason, but you know, but I miss, as we're talking about writing, I miss it. I miss that universe that we create and control.
It's that, you know, you mentioned earlier this idea of like negative space. I mean, like when you're writing, it's like the world that actually exists around you becomes that sort of negative space because you're inhabiting this other place for a time. And like it exists in some ways only in your mind, but then like the magic of it all is that that won't always be the case. And I think that there is some like tacit understanding of that while, you know, your fingers are at the keyboard or while you're gripping a pen. It's just like, I'm telling myself this story, but at some point I'll be able to shape it such that others are going to get, you know, their version of this story through my words. And there's just so much negative space like around that process. But when people are holding that book and when they're reading it, you know, you as a reader know this, I as a reader know it, that's where you are. And it just like, it mirrors it. It's like sort of like the, and it's like the stepping through the mirror and just like seeing that the experience on the other side of it is the same, but different. And that's where that empathy comes in. And that's really why we do this. It's just right. Like we're trying to share bits and pieces of our experience, like through these characters that we have created and who must necessarily represent parts of who we are. There's no way around it, no matter how far removed you think you are from a particular character or their experience, whatever the case is. So I mean, I could go on about this for a long time, but like, it's just so reassuring to know that that's always going to be there, even if it's, you do have to find yourself in that like terrible rat race part of it eventually, if you want to pursue the traditional publishing route anyway.
Right. I know. But I miss the love. Like you just revived in me the love for the process and the sitting there and creating something, which is, it's something that's been lost along the way. And it's a good day for you to have revived that creativity and, you know, love.
Gives you that brief moment of escape before you have to think about the yoga that you've got before you later today, right?
Exactly. Which I'm scared shitless about. I'm sure I'm going to fuck it up or whatever. But
I feel you on that though, because I started playing Dungeons and Dragons this year with a group of people online.
Yeah.
And they seem to have discovered my knack for doing different voices and found out I was an author. And so guess who gets to be the dungeon master for our new campaign?
I had a feeling that we were going with dungeon master. Yeah.
Yeah. It's me. And so starting in 2021, like I'm going to be taking over with a new campaign. And even though I feel super prepared, I know that a week from, you know, tomorrow as of the date of recording, I'm going to be sitting there all day like, all right, I need to find ways to mitigate, you know, the extent to which I can fuck up tonight's session. Like yeah, the first right. one happens to go perfect, right? And it's like, it's not gonna, but you get that idea in your head at least.
Absolutely. And I was practicing my sequence, you know, I have to create the sequence, which is cool because it is sort of like writing and it's like flowing and I have this whole story about this goddess, Saraswati, who is the goddess of like knowledge, but also like books and music and whatever. Exactly. And so we, you know, she, whatever, I have the story in my head. I have it all. It's very convoluted. Honestly, my intro, it's like supposed to be like a Dharma talk. It's like 10 pages, single space. Like, you know, like I probably am going to spend more time talking because that's where I do. And then once I start moving my body, I can't remember words or names anymore. So I'm like, I can't remember what this part of your body is called at any point in time. I want to call this the arm shin.
Yeah, I guess it kind of is. I mean, it's like your under forearm or something.
Yeah, so I'm going to call it the arm shin.
All right, arm shin's great. I knew it. It's kind of like in German, the word for glove is Handschuh.
Ooh, I like that.
I know, right? It's perfect. We should have kept more of that German when English was evolving over time. I don't know what we were thinking.
Yes, we should have kept more of that German, said no one.
Linguistically.
Sorry, I couldn't. And
I understand, but it's linguistically.
It's fantastic that I end on like a Holocaust joke.
Tough times, Lindsay. I don't know. Tough times. I don't know.
Ryan, thank you so much for sharing your story. And obviously, I think the mental health system is broken. And one of the things that I always make a point of doing when talking with people, with my patients, is distinguishing like thoughts and feelings and intent, you know, and like, let's flesh it out. Like, let's put these words out there. Let's, you know, like I forced myself to ask how your father attempted because I want it to be a more comfortable thing for us to talk about. And, and yet I still had to force myself to do it because it feels like such a personal invasion, but, but I do appreciate your sharing your story.
Yeah, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak about it, you know, particularly in this context, because it's like a lot of the topics that folks are going to hear me talking about out there, it's all writing stuff. And I think we lose track of like how vivid and real everyone's life is on the other side of a microphone when it's not just like R. Campbell walking you through, you know, writing tips. It's like you in our pre, you know, conversation before we started recording here, it's like you have the opportunity to share and like know what someone's got going on in their life other than what's going to be at hand here. So yeah, I appreciate the opportunity and you know, it's good to get it out there, I guess.
I agree.
Thanks for listening to the Neurotic Nourishment Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends, shout from rooftops, smoke signals, hot air balloons, whatever. I'll take any of it. And if you really like what you're listening, why don't you become a patron? Join our Patreon. Visit us at patreon.com/neuroticnourishment. Thanks.